We cover many serious issues in this podcast. This discussion may contain reference to domestic violence, sexual violence, violence against children, suicide, drug use, or graphic depictions of death or dead bodies. It is not suitable for all audiences.
Tonight on Unsolved Mysteries Rewind, two friends get together to discuss episodes of their favorite television show, Unsolved Mysteries. Will they find answers? Will anyone care? You may be able to solve a mystery.
Hello, you are listening to Unsolved Mysteries Rewind. My name is Mark, and I am on with my co-host, Kim. Welcome to the show, Kim.
Oh, why, thank you so much.
Today we are discussing a pretty good episode. I kind of just closed my eyes and pointed, and I think sometimes that works. and certainly in this one, we're talking about Backyard Bones, Twins Behind Bars, Ghost Goes to Court, and Sharon Kinney. Is that it?
Yeah, Sharon Kinney. And I was very disappointed in Ghost Goes to Court because I was picturing like a courthouse ghost. Like, I object.
You can't handle the truth. So
yeah, exactly. But yeah, we're talking season 10, episode 6.
Yeah, it originally aired sometime between 1997 and 1999, somewhere there. It's very loose.
Kind of all over the place. But yeah, this first one is a story that actually takes place on June 5th of 1997. The San Antonio, Texas Police Department receive an anonymous call. And the caller says that Monica Rizzo was murdered by her husband, Leonard Rizzo, and that her bones are in the backyard of the Rizzo's house.
Wow. I mean, I'm wondering, when a police department receives an anonymous call like this, I mean, any call like this, I guess they have to take it somewhat seriously, right? This is a way to really mess with somebody.
Yeah, and I believe that they did take it exactly that somewhat seriously, because they do go out to the house, and they don't really exert themselves too much, but yeah. When they get there, Leonard Rizzo is actually, like, seizing out. He's having a seizure. So they ship him off, the husband, in an ambulance, and police kind of question the son. The son says he hasn't seen his mom in like a week. You know, there's nothing amiss in the house. Her car is parked in the driveway, and police search the backyard, and they do find bones, but they find that these bones are like obviously animal bones.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of interesting. I guess maybe they were distracted by the seizure, and then they're like, all right, well, look, we're here, let's go take a look in the backyard. Clearly they saw these bones, and they are somebody saw these bones and they think that it's somebody, and when
and like, I know that you said, like, why not search a little harder, and I do think that they were probably distracted by these bones, but, you know, keep in mind, if you don't have a search warrant and he has not given you permission to search his house because he's having a seizure and is shipped off in an ambulance, all you can see is what you can see. Like, if you're a police officer, you're not allowed to open any drawers, you're not allowed to turn over any tires in the backyard. Like, you are only allowed to see what is out in the open.
Yeah, I mean, without permission.
Right, and he didn't have permission. They got permission from the son, but it's not the son's house. You'd have to have permission from Leonard.
See, I'm wondering, being somebody who is a resident of the house, I wonder if they can offer permission. I guess maybe it would depend on the age of the son.
Exactly. It would depend on the age of the son. And we do know that that son actually did die like a year after all of this took place. He had leukemia, sadly, and he died at, I believe, 19. So he would have been right on the cusp of being able to give permission, if that's even a thing. I don't even know.
I think the police were just kind of like, well, you know, there's a seizure. Let's, you know, deal with this. This is more action than what we expected anyway.
Yeah, and the animal bones. So they're like, this dummy was confused. Because it is clearly like an animal's skull. Like, it looks like a cow or something is in the backyard.
Yeah, so everybody has a cow skull in their backyard.
Oh my gosh. But on May 5th of 1997, so we're walking this back a month, we learn that Monica was working, and on her lunch break, she just left. She didn't even take a purse or anything. So her boss, Gilbert, is calling her like crazy, trying to get a hold of her. And he doesn't get a hold of her until 8 days later. And she tells him, like, I'm all fine, but I'm not going to return to work until May 19th, which is 2 weeks after she left.
And do we know what she does? Because it looks like a bank.
No, I don't know what she does. I do know that she works for the government in some aspect.
But I mean, it's just, I don't understand any job that you can have where you can just kind of not show up and then say, oh, and by the way, I'm not going to come in for a total of 2 weeks.
I know. I don't either. Maybe she was banking all those sick days. I really have no idea how this worked, but her coworkers had seen bruises on her before and noticed that she had lost like a dramatic amount of weight. So I think they knew, you know, maybe let's give her some room, stuff's going on, but still no call, no showing for 8 days. I mean, you think that would be enough to get the police involved?
I would imagine that it would have been, if it's a government facility, they would have some type of plan in place where they would have to notify the police if somebody doesn't show up just for a wellness visit after like 72 hours.
Yeah, I would think so too, especially knowing that she may be in an abusive relationship, allegedly. But on May 27th of 1997, son Vincent says that this is the last time that he sees his mom alive is around midnight. And he doesn't even live in the house. He's older. He's out of the house. So Leonard, the husband, says that he just woke up one morning and she was gone, and he never reported it to the police because, you know, oh, women are so crazy and sometimes they just leave. So Leonard Rizzo actually talks to Unsolved Mysteries, and it is so crazy when guys, and I'll put him in the camp of like Steve Page, Jewel Taylor, like these guys come on and are like, I'm so charming, I'm going to convince the nation.
Yeah.
Yeah, so on July 5th, so a month after that first phone call that police got, the anonymous caller again calls the police station. And he's like, you guys, I told you there is bones in the back of the house, and go look near the tires in the backyard. And we later learn that this anonymous caller is a family friend named Robert, who noticed his dog playing with a jawbone in the backyard. And he said, oh, you know, I haven't seen Monica, and those teeth actually overlap like Monica's did. So he's the one who kind of blew the whistle on all of this.
Very strange, too, because the whole thing is like the anonymous call. He must be very frustrated because he's trying to like really stay out of it, but to get somebody involved in it. You got to go get your dog some special shots, I'm assuming. I mean, this isn't something that, you know, you just let your dog chew on a human jaw and just let it move on. It's such a gross visual with the fact that he's looking at it close enough where he's like, oh, that looks like Monica's teeth. And I just don't know if I would personally be able to identify somebody from a jawbone. And I don't want to have either to try.
No, me neither. I hope that neither of us are ever in that situation. But like, to add to the grossness, police do find a bunch of human bones in the backyard. And I quote, a bag of what appeared to be human flesh.
When I heard that, right? Because that is a quote that really sticks with you. A bag full of human, that appeared to be human flesh. I was thinking of, you know, when you go to IKEA and you get those big blue bags.
I'm so scared where this is going.
No, I picture kind of an industrial, heavy, thick bag that's wrinkly and gross. And I just have this visual of something nasty. And
yeah, and they just showed it in like a household white garbage bag, like a 13-gallon kitchen garbage bag.
Yeah, I mean, that's what they showed it in, but I had a different visual.
Yeah, I mean, it's this whole thing is so bonkers. So police go inside the house. And they're like, oh, huh, there's like bashed walls and there's blood spattered all over the house. Weird that we didn't notice this a month ago. So Leonard is like, someone is setting me up. I have no idea how the body parts got there. And the house is messed up because, you know, when your wife's missing and whatever, you just punch holes in the wall because I'm so frustrated.
He's telling jokes at this point. He's like, yeah, I took it out on the house, but the house won. Ha ha ha.
Yeah, and he's laughing. Oh, it's so creepy. So, like, before all this happened, Monica's coworkers were worried about her, and they asked police to check on her. Her weight at one point had gotten down to 85 pounds.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and we see the police doing a wellness check on her, obviously, before all this went down. And in the reenactment, at least, she has like a bruised and battered neck and throat and a black eye and all this stuff. And she's like, my husband doesn't want to talk to you. Like, he's sick. I can't bring him to the door or whatever. So now,
what is an officer should to do in your opinion, or maybe even lawfully, when they go there and they see that there's visual signs of abuse, but she's denying, she's saying, mm-hmm. I ran into a door or whatever they say in these, not so uncommon domestic violence situations. I'm just wondering, does the police officer have the right to say, I'd like to speak to you and your husband right now?
What I think should happen, obviously, is that she should be taken to like a safe place and he should be talked to seriously and maybe locked up. But what I know from like watching Cops and stuff,
yeah.
is that there's nothing they can do unless she is going to file a complaint. Even if she doesn't like testify against him, as soon as she files a complaint, it is now the state of Texas versus Leonard Rizzo or whatever. Like, but she has to take that first step, which is always tricky, as we say every time on this freaking show. You know, that's the most dangerous time for a woman, is when she's leaving an abusive relationship.
It's almost as though if she were to attack the officer, it might be the safest move at that point, because he would have to take her in.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, yeah. And
not like, you know, not to really try to harm him, but just say, why don't you just leave and take a swing or something?
Mm-hmm. I can only imagine what happens when she got back in that house. You know, what did you call the cops, you stupid woman? You know, like, yeah. Ugh, I'm sure it was hell for her. But police, because they find all of these bones, they bring in archaeologists from the University of Texas to kind of excavate the backyard. So the team, whenever they find a little chunk of bone or something that they thought would be evidence, they would put these little orange flags out. And apparently the yard was like covered in these flags. And the Dr. Bob Hard. Yeah. He says that the bones were still greasy. And he's like, anytime you're digging up old bones, they're going to be dry. They're going to be brittle. But these were like fresh, basically.
Gross.
So there's bone fragments no bigger than 3 inches all over the place, even in the barbecue grill.
And they're clean cut. Like it's they're not like cracked. There's no splintering. They're broken up.
Yeah, there's no like serrated edge from like a saw or something like that.
It's like mulch in a way. Like, I mean, that's really what I was thinking. And I think that they were thinking as well, because they thought it seems as though it's possible that a chipper or a shredder was used to break the body down.
Yeah, and Leonard's like, I've never used a wood chipper. In fact, I've never even like rented equipment from a place, which is an odd distinction to make. But we talked to Sergeant Ernest Celaya, who says that Monica's case, even though they found like 200 bone fragments in the backyard, Monica is just a missing person. There is no proof that a crime has occurred.
Yeah, that seems a bit much. I just kind of don't understand at what point, how much of the body do you need to find to determine that she's in fact dead?
And like, what body parts is a jawbone not good enough for you? Like, you know?
Right. How are you going to go living without part of your head attached?
Yeah. God, it's so messed up. I mean, why would there be bones anyway? Eve, obviously, but I'm just going a step beyond that. So police at first actually thought that these belonged to up to 4 different people. It turns out DNA, we get DNA later in an update, and they do all belong to Monica. But for whatever reason, having bones of possibly up to 4 different people in your backyard is not a good enough reason to get you arrested, because Leonard is out, free, and clear.
This is crazy. I mean, I just feel as though, me personally, if my wife went missing and you found body parts of her scattered around my backyard, I don't know. I just don't feel as though I'd be off.
Yeah. No, I don't know. I would be the anonymous caller.
Something happened here. I mean, there's like definitely oversight or police laziness. There's something going on here that we're not privy to.
I know. And again, this kind of reminds me of Steve and Kathy Page, like that 3 billboards case that was inspired by 3 billboards. It's like, what has to happen in order for police to look into a woman's murder? Like, what else is there to do? It's ridiculous.
Right. It's like they always say, well, without a body, we can't do anything. It's like, all right, well, you know what? You do have a body if you scoop it all up together.
Yeah, you got most of a body here, and that's pretty weird. I mean, if any of my bones show up in the backyard, I'd hope somebody would take a look at it. But
I think what he did is he took the big body parts. I mean, this is so gross. And at least in the reenactment, he had a barbecue grill there. Mm-hmm. And I think he just basically cooked it. He just cooked it and singed it until it was ash.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely possible. I mean, I showed you the house it was on. It was kind of a cul-de-sac. I feel like you would know if your neighbor was, like, grilling up some dead body. Like, I feel like that would smell, probably.
But here's the thing. Like, I'm always smoking meat in my backyard. There's always plumes of smoke coming out of my backyard. And you put that connected to my Google history, all of a sudden things get a little bit weird. Because later on, we talk a little bit about fingerprinting shotgun shells. But, so, I don't know. I mean, is it possible the guy was just like, I mean, it's Texas. It's barbecue nation.
That's true.
I'm just wondering out loud about that. But I just imagine that it's not totally uncommon to have some weird smell. Like, oh, yeah, it smells terrible. But maybe you cover it up with another cherry wood or something. I also looked at real estate in the area. And I just want to mention that. I don't know what the crime is like. I don't know if this case is a determination of whether the area is dangerous. But for less than $200,000, you can get a pretty nice house with like an in-ground pool. And, you know, some of the houses look really nice. If you add another $100,000, you're getting $1 million Long Island house. So it's kind of really crazy.
Yeah, as a woman, I think I'm going to stay out of Texas because it's obvious that no one will investigate it if I die. But I do want to give an update on this very interesting thing that happens in 1999. So this is 2 years later. We find out that Leonard is arrested for attacking his girlfriend. He was convicted on 4 counts, including assault with a deadly weapon and kidnapping and possession of methamphetamine.
It's the drug of choice for Unsolved Mysteries veterans, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we are hard-pressed to find a murdery case without meth being involved. So I couldn't find the case file. I found this from Reddit. So, you know, obviously take it with a grain of salt. But I would like to read this in its entirety because I do think it's interesting. So he was sentenced, we're talking about Leonard, was sentenced to a 2-year prison term for aggravated assault on his then-girlfriend, Susan, and with the pair high on methamphetamines and deprived of sleep, Susan claimed that Leonard became paranoid and that he beat her with a hammer after accusing her of knowing where Monica was. When Susan, accompanied by police, went back the next day to retrieve her belongings from the mobile home, Leonard became difficult. After 4 hours, Leonard fired a gun, pointed it at the police officer, and a SWAT officer had to come in and shoot Leonard in the stomach. His girlfriend, that's the end of the Reddit thing.
And he lived, right?
Or he did live, yeah, and he was sentenced to 2 years. His girlfriend told the police that he threatened to, quote, kill her, chop her up, put her in a garbage bag, and bury her.
Just like the other one.
Well, this whole thing reminds me, it was just like the other one, but this whole thing, again, with the Kathy Page thing about the billboards. I mean, apparently you can, one of the billboards says, you know, this is whatever county, city of Vidor. Here you can get away with brutally murdering a woman. And sounds like it.
Yeah, it's also, it's sickening that it needed to get this far. And this guy's just going out and repeating these same exact actions with other people when, I mean, I think I've been very open with, you know, I just feel as though some people need to be, you know, put to death. And this is just somebody who's, personally, in my opinion, that the world would have been a little bit of a better place without him on it.
You know, here's the thing. It worked the first time, allegedly. So why wouldn't he just keep doing the same thing? You know, it's crazy. But
it's like a shoplifter in a way. You know, it's like, well, I'm not going to get caught until you get caught.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah. He's not having any consequences for his actions. Something I did find, too, is that because Monica worked for the state, even though she went missing in 1997, Leonard allegedly kept cashing in on her state employment benefits, which I'm guessing is some kind of pension. So the benefits people said that the benefits are going to have to be on hold until the criminal investigation into his involvement in her disappearance was wrapped up. So he actually sued them and he lost. And that's it's just crazy. Monica's dad wrote a book about the story called The Raw Truth. It's by William McKinney. And yeah, as we said before, their son Leonardo actually died shortly thereafter from leukemia.
Which might have been his own saving grace because he didn't have to go through so much of this and the aftermath of this like lunatic.
Oh, it's horrible.
Yeah,
It's so sad.
it is. It's very sad. But what's also sad is I'm taking a ride down south to Greensboro, North Carolina. It's the early 90s, June 9th. It's the beginning of summer, really, in 1993. It's called Twins Behind Bars, and we have two of the cutest twins in the
Oh my
world.
God. They were adorable.
Twins are
and
always
good-looking
cute
men.
together, but they're
Yeah.
good-looking, cute guys. Like, they're good-looking guys. And if they had just kept their noses clean, who knows what could have happened. We see a reenactment where there's a number of people hanging out in a motel room. This girl's getting ice, and they go, I don't know how accurate all of this is. She goes back, she gives us what seems to be a special knock on the door. And she walks past two men on her way back to her room. They go to open the door, and these guys just kind of bust in with guns and they rob them. They basically steal cash and jewelry. I'd like to personally know who these people are, the money that was taken and the jewelry
Oh,
that was
yeah.
taken. There had to have been a decent haul in order to go through this. They said that it took just a matter of minutes. They did kick in the bathroom. I'm like, oh, that would be me. Like, I'd be in the bathroom when this happened. I always think
Yeah.
about that.
It looks scary. I mean, these guys are pointing guns. Like, it looked very scary.
They arrest three men who were in connection of one of which is Frederick Young, who's 22 years old. The thing is that he was sentenced until his 91st birthday, so he got about a 70-year sentence for this crime. You did a lot of digging and found that he does have a history of crime, but it just seems to be a hefty penalty for a crime where nobody was shot. No, the guns weren't even fired, from what we understand. It was a
Yeah, no.
robbery. So I'm not really sure why 7 decades would be thrown at this person.
It seems like a really, really long time. It says like he'll be in there till his 91st birthday. It's like, good Lord.
And it's almost like he woke up one day and he's like, wait a second, I have a twin.
Yeah, I
It wasn't
know.
me. It wasn't me.
Which I mean, talk about reasonable doubt.
No, it's right. I agree with you. I don't know the end of the story. I don't know who's lying and who's not. But his twin brother, who's an identical twin,
Yeah, Cedric. So we have Cedric and Frederick. Frederick is the guy who gets arrested, but supposedly, pretty much everyone thinks that Cedric did it. And I have to say, I'm in the minority on the internet that thinks that both these twins are kind of scumbags.
Oh, yeah,
Like,
totally. They have almost identical rap sheets.
yeah, and everybody's like, oh my God, my heart breaks for him. I've seen this case plastered all over all the Unsolved Mysteries pages on Facebook and stuff just very recently. And everyone's like, how could he do that to his own brother? I think both these brothers kind of suck.
I bet you they've done, if not the same type of things, exactly the same other things and just weren't caught. So
Yeah.
they're both kind of guilty for a number of things. So yeah, I don't think anybody's innocent in this story.
Yeah, and the mom says, like, oh my God, nobody can tell these two apart. Nobody can tell these two apart. Well, guess what? I can tell these two apart.
Yeah, get some
Frederick
glasses,
has a
lady.
scar. Yeah. Well, Frederick has a scar on his forehead. Am I going to see this when somebody is pointing a gun at me in a motel room? No. But she said, like, cousins and, like, their own siblings couldn't tell them apart. I don't buy that.
Even in photographs, they look. You can kind of see that one is slightly different. Now, I grew up with two twins and they were identical. Like one had the slightest crooked tooth. It was almost the only way I could tell. And it's like smile, and it's like that's not going to happen. So it's weird. It's one of these kind of weird stories. Do you want to tell the story about how he was caught? Because that is one of the things where it kind of brings the shadiness to light, I
I
think.
agree, but I definitely also think that this cop was like racially profiling, lest we forget it is like North Carolina, but It's June 10th, 1993. So it's the night after this robbery happens. And Frederick, the supposed innocent one, is pulled over because his license plate light is out.
I don't know if that's racially profiling, though.
I mean, I don't.
I'm not saying that racism doesn't have an existence down south, because it certainly does. I'm just saying that I've been pulled over for my light, you know, and got a ticket. And I think if I didn't have my driver's license on me, and on top of it, it would come out to be what you're about to talk about. I don't know. I think I would be taken into custody. Personally.
I mean, not for nothing. Like, you are kind of dark.
This is right. You're absolutely right. But yeah,
I'm just saying, like, I feel like if I'm driving down the road and I know, I'm sorry, but I'm like pale as can be. I don't think I'm necessarily getting pulled over for my light being out. I feel like that's a reason that cops pull over.
One way to find out, Kim.
Let's do it. You and me both. We'll go. We'll see who gets pulled over first.
No way, dude. I'm a person of color.
Yeah. Well, so it turns out that they're like, give us your license. You know, your light plate is out. So he's like, oh my God, I don't have my license on me. And it turns out that his license is revoked. So he gives Cedric's name. And he's like, my name's Cedric, even though he's Frederick. And it turns out Cedric's license is also revoked.
I'm just want to say, just say it's Rick. You know what I mean? Like, just say your name is Rick. You're it's both, you know?
Interesting. Yeah, that's true. I didn't think about that. But the cops are like, well, can we search the car? And he's like, yeah, go ahead, search the car. So under the passenger seat, they find a bag, and Frederick says he's never seen this bag before. And in that bag a sawed-off shotgun that just so happened to be the same exact gun used in the robbery the night before.
Maybe. I still don't know how they would be able to determine. All right, granted, all right, they found a sawed-off shotgun. He matches the ID of this person that had the gun. But how do they know that this is the same gun? From what I understand, I did a little bit of research and in this like firearm forum, and some shotguns are traceable, but sawed-off shotguns don't have as much of a barrel. So if it's if it is a slug a round, it's more traceable. But if it's a buckshot, it's not traceable. But they didn't fire it. From what we understand.
Yeah. I don't know if it was just like a unique looking gun. I know it is illegal to have a sawed off shotgun.
Yeah, like did it have a Pokemon sticker on it? I'm not really sure.
Who knows? Yeah, so they take him to the police station and he's like, all right, you guys, I'm going to come clean with you. My name's actually Frederick. It's not really Cedric, which is a little late for this because they already found a gun in your car. So they get him, charge him with...
Can you see him like saying that and like getting up, zipping up his coat? He's like, well, I'll see you guys later.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So we're cool. But he is charged with 6 counts of armed robbery, as was his alleged accomplice, Chris Ross. Now, we meet Chris Ross. This guy...
Another good-looking guy.
Oh, yeah. No, very cute. But he could not stop smiling.
Yeah, he was happy to be there.
Yeah, but it made it look like everything he said was a lie. So we're at trial. It's a year later. And one of the victims at the motel testifies that she recognizes Frederick from the holdup. So they're like, can you point to him? And she points to Frederick. And Frederick says at that moment, he was like, oh, my God, it must have been Cedric who did this. Like, who else looks like me but Cedric?
Yeah, so I don't know.
But that didn't dawn on you for a whole year.
You've been saying it since you were 4. You know, like, nope, that was my brother. That's a twin thing. I mean, that's what they do. They blame it on the other twin.
Yeah, 100%.
My father was a twin. I know what the blame game. I know how far it goes.
I mean, isn't that half the point of being a twin, is that you got someone to play tricks with? But
right. Exactly.
He says he had ineffective assistance of counsel, which everybody says once they get charged. But it does seem like this guy was very ineffective. And his attorney's bar card was like suspended for various violations. He wouldn't talk to his clients. He never reached out to them. Nothing like that. So Chris Ross, the alleged accomplice, said that he put the shotgun in the car without Frederick's knowing. But he didn't say anything about it because no one asked him.
Eek.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's one of those kind of things where, you know, he's really just trying to get a little scratch off some of the years on his own personal sentence.
And it works because he took a plea for 20 years.
Which is pretty damn, I mean, that's pretty amazing. That's, you know.
20 versus 70, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big part. That's, you know, that's a long time to get taken off. Not to mention, as we've learned in the past, you never really do the whole time anyway.
Yeah, 20 years means like 8, probably. So, Frederick refuses the plea because he says he's innocent, so why would he plea? And he ends up getting sentenced to 68 years. We get his like current attorney talking to Unsolved Mysteries, his good attorney, you know, he got a better one. And then we get the cop being like, nope, he was guilty. So Frederick appeals, it goes to the Court of Appeals, and they said, if there's any new evidence, we'll take a look at it. So they bring up Chris Ross, the alleged accomplice, up to the stand, and they question him. And Chris says that it was Cedric who committed the robbery, not Frederick. But Frederick was still denied a new trial. So the twins go on like the pinnacle of class in the 90s, the Geraldo Rivera show.
I mean, he was a part of all of those things. Like, you know, there was like the Maury Povich show and all of these trashy shows that we all kind of love and kind of hate. Yeah, I mean, I never really watched any of these shows, but they were definitely on my radar.
I love these shows, and I think you know that I went to a taping of these shows not that long ago, and I'm in the audience like, boo! Like,
which one did you? I don't remember the show. I
went to the Steve Wilkos show and the Jerry Springer show.
That is so funny.
It was awesome. Yeah, we almost went to Maury, but we had to leave a day early because they tape in the same place. But it was so much fun. But this Geraldo show is entitled Twin Horrors, the horrible things that twins can do to each other. And this is where Frederick puts Cedric on blast and says Cedric did it. And Cedric denies it. They both cry, allegedly. Cedric, there's no tears coming out. But Frederick's does seem to be actually crying.
Did we mention that the mom has completely sided with Frederick?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, the mom is like, oh, Cedric is the one who did this. And I don't know, is this just stirring up enough reasonable doubt? Like, what do you think's happening? Do you think she actually believes that?
I don't know. I mean, everybody, I'm going to guess that every parent understands that one of your kids can be like a piece of crap, maybe. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Maybe he's the one who robbed her, you know what I mean? Like, you know, woke up, there's no TV. I don't know. It's just one of those crazy things to side with somebody publicly, you know, to side with a sibling over another sibling publicly. Yeah. It has to be something there. There's a story there.
I agree. And, you know, my mom always had this thing where I'd be like, Mom, Katie did this about my sister. And she'd be like, what were you doing? Coloring holy pictures. And I think Frederick's acting like he was coloring holy pictures because he has been, Frederick, the guy who's supposedly innocent, has been in and out of jail since 1988 on charges, including breaking and entering, grand larceny, assault on a female, and assault with a deadly weapon. So I don't view robbery as completely out of left field here. Mm-hmm. We do learn that in March of 2016, Frederick is released, and Cedric, since 1989, has been in and out of prison on charges including possession, concealing a weapon, multiple charges of larceny, child abuse, breaking and entering, and shoplifting.
Dude, like, what is going on? Like, I mean, it's just crazy to me. So, from what we understand, Frederick is still out.
Yep, Frederick's still out. Cedric is in and out. I really couldn't find an updated thing of him. I don't think he's in North Carolina anymore, where I do think Frederick is still in North Carolina. But both of these guys are proven thieves with weapons. That is in the court records. So,
and I don't think that they deserve the death penalty. You know, I just want to clear up my earlier statement with this, you know, the wife beater earlier, wife murderer, chipper upper, versus somebody like this. You know, these guys could go there and, you know, with the proper program, maybe wake up a little bit, you know, and grow up a little bit versus somebody who's just like a lunatic.
I agree. And I don't even think either of these guys deserve 70 years. That is crazy.
Yeah. The too young to give that type of sentence. But one of the things I would do at this period of time, what they should have done is jumped over and flown to England.
Woohoo! International Unsolved Mysteries.
Yeah, like that's what they should have done. They instead of robbing these people, they should have went and bought real estate, cheap real estate in London. Not London. They're not far from London. Yeah, but
Upper Mayfield, England.
Yeah, this is not a great area or anything, I don't think. And but it's an old area, and it's I don't know how old this house is. I couldn't find any real info on Lowe's Cottage.
Yeah, Lowe's.
But I love the name. I'd love to live in a place that's just referred to as Lowe's Cottage. I can't say it.
I know. I swear, like, when I have a house that has a name, I'll know I have arrived. Like, how many times do we see this in, like, upper crust kind of places? But I will say, I mean, you are, like, slammed up against other people. I have a picture of it. We'll post on the Facebook pages. It's not like you got, like, acreage, or it's not like a farm or anything.
Well, it's an old farmhouse. So I'm going to assume that all of the property that surrounds it was at one time owned by the people who owned that house.
Yeah, well, we do have in 1994, Andrew and Josie Smith moved their family into this place, which is, because it's so old, it is a fixer-upper, and they got it for super cheap, converting like pounds in 1994. I got that. It's around $34,000 that they got this place for.
Now, what did they pay? What was the, how many pounds did they pay?
I had it, but I translated everything into dollars so I wouldn't confuse
them. I mean, that's probably about 10,000 pounds back then. I deal with pounds from time to time because of a London property that I have to deal with.
You have a London flat.
You want it?
I'll take it.
Yeah. It's yours. But yeah, it's probably like 10 grand, you know, and that's pretty amazing, you know. But, you know, doing a fixer-upper there, things were not really built really that well. Again, I don't know how old this place is. I'm going to guess it's like an early 1800s type of property.
Yeah, they said it was at least like 280 years old.
Also even older. But yeah, these cobblestones and everything, I mean, I call them topple stones because this stuff is just made with like oatmeal and stones. It's terrible. You know, this stuff is always falling, whole roofs slide off. It's crazy. It's like Benny Hill built these things. But the way they show it, the way they presented this particular segment, which I think we can just kind of blast through because I don't know if there's that much to discuss here. But I loved the way this segment looked. I felt as though it was really appropriate for Halloween, which by the time this is released will have been about 6 weeks ago.
And, long past, yeah.
Yeah. And we, you know, this felt more of a Halloween segment than the actual Halloween segment from Unsolved Mysteries. If you want to tell the story, and you know, I don't know. I just think it seems mostly made up to me personally. But
and look, here's the thing, and I wrote this on our notes, and I'll just tell you guys, like, do I believe in ghosts? Yeah, I'm open to that idea. Do I believe that scammers are going to scam? Yeah, 100%. Like, yeah. I think that's what we have going on here. But right after they move in, they start noticing temperature variations. The room is like hazy.
The house is 300 years old. Mine is 100. There's temperature changes everywhere, every room I walk into.
Exactly. And they said like objects were rattling. They saw ghosts, like actual ghosts.
Yeah.
Ghosts maybe would strangle them in the night. Like, crazy stuff. According to this article that I read, they also claim to have seen apparitions of a naked girl, a pig-faced boy, and it is alleged that Mrs. Smith was sexually assaulted by one of these ghosts.
In the shower?
No, but this is the second horny ghost story that we have had. How weird is that?
I don't know if it's as weird as it is interesting.
Oh my God, I do not want to read your diary.
But, your diary today.
The sellers of the house.
Wait, I'm sorry. Can I, since we're on ghosts, I keep interrupting you this episode, and I'm sorry, Kim. To give an update of any apparitions that are in my house here on Strong Island, there's been nothing since we had our water main done. It's been, the house is just kind of eh. So I'm wondering if it's possible that the regrounding, because we had our whole house regrounded for, you know, just electrical issues and stuff like that. I wonder if it could have been associated with EMF changes. It's totally possible. And we don't get a weird feeling in our basement anymore. And it's a lot of issues that kind of went away.
before.
Right before.
The day before. Yeah, yeah. Like multiple times.
Yeah, but I don't know. That could also have been my imagination playing tricks on me. You know, I was also under a lot of stress because of the amount of money it was costing. And they, all these strangers in my house and their dirty boots, you know. I felt like Monk. Can you take your boots off when you come through my house? It's like, no, we're traveling through mud. Anyway, so yeah, I just want, that's the update. I haven't seen anything, but I will look, start, you know, again, very soon. I don't really look for it, but I'm going to ask my wife tonight. I'll ask Ramiel and we'll see.
Okay. Well, the sellers of the house of Lowe's Cottage are like, these people are full of baloney. We've lived there our whole lives, so we never noticed anything weird. So what do? The Smiths go to a local church to have a priest perform an exorcism on the house, which is like always everybody's first step in these stories. It's so weird. So he does. He goes, he blesses the house, and all is calm and peaceful until a few hours later, and the radio starts like blasting in the middle of the night. So
they pretty nice stereo system, by the way. They had like a nice retro 70s Silverface stereo.
Totally. And they begin like asking around about their house. So apparently they are like the only ones who didn't know that this house is super haunted. So the story is that during the 1860s, there was a young milkmaid named Elaine Herring who lived in the cottage with her lover, Joseph Phillips, which scandal.
Oh, brother.
She was supposedly murdered by her employer and died in the cellar of Lowe's Cottage, which is currently the kitchen area of the house. And Joseph Phillip was said to be so distraught that he hung himself by the body of his lover. And the sisters are like, this is all crap. Like, we don't know what you're talking about. They even say they're trying to get out of paying because there was still 6,000 pounds that they owed left on the house. And they were like, we are not going to pay this because you sold us a haunted house.
I love the sisters because it's like they tell this whole story and we see the reenactment. And then they get to the sister and it's like, that's bullshit. Oh, I shouldn't. Totally. I didn't mean to curse, but it's like, that's crap.
I curse all the time on this show. But the Smiths had apparently, they really publicized all the stuff that was happening to try and build up their case. And it kind of bit them in the butt because it actually brought their home value down when they tried to refinance. Strange. From 70,000 pounds to 20,000 pounds.
Which is weird. It's kind of like, is it really that popular of a story that it's really affecting the home value?
I mean, you know, do banks need an excuse really to be like, no, that will
not at all.
So they file a lawsuit against the sisters because they have got some chutzpah and they are like, you sold us ghosts and we don't want them. So the sisters ended up countersuing for the 6,000 pounds that the Smiths failed to pay for the property. So the Smiths hire two paranormal investigators to get proof that the house is haunted. So we get to see this footage of where they set up night vision candles and they place candles. They set up night vision cameras and set two candles on a set of stairs. And both of the candles were disturbed. And one appears to be like chucked across the room.
Yeah, it's not the most convincing footage I've ever seen. I don't know why night vision can see ghosts or a thing. I mean, we could have seen the candle with the lights on, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know why ghosts are so scared of the dark. But, you know, and I'm not trying to say I don't believe in ghosts and I don't believe in this kind of stuff. But I don't believe that this really creepy house, which is really cool looking when it's lit properly, is haunted. I think it's all hooey. And we find out that after this kind of all settled, then no other ghostly sightings have been reported.
Well, yeah. So this battle raged on for over 5 years, this court battle. And in 1999, a judge ruled against the Smiths, saying that likely the disturbances were human and not paranormal. And then all of a sudden, oh my God, there's no more ghosts in this house. Like, just like, boom. Weird.
But the value of the house did go up.
Yeah, it was reversed back because of the judge saying there's no ghost here. The house value did go from 20,000 pounds to 70,000 pounds. The Smiths moved out, a new family moved in, and it is currently valued at 241,000 pounds, which is like $331,000.
Now, I'm going to say that this took on a story of its own. You could find other paranormal investigators talking about this, and it's become another spot to drive by in a ghost, in a type of ghost tour in the area. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I feel like England is probably very haunted because everything's so old.
Yeah. It's one of those things. It's kind of like Salem, Massachusetts. And mm-hmm. These are very old areas, cemeteries, very old. And a rickety old house, and it's a cool-looking house from a distance. And I don't like these houses, personally.
Oh.
They look like they're going to fall down, that's all. Sorry.
They do. But you know what I like?
What?
This next story. Oh, my God, it was so entertaining.
I've never heard of this woman before, did you?
Me neither. No, me neither. And this they is a said big that one. To, yeah. They said she was featured on a show called Deadly Women, which is like my current favorite true crime because it is so cheesy and I freaking love it. But I've never even seen the story on Deadly Women. It was like season 2 and they don't have that on Hulu. So anyway.
Well, buckle up because this is a crazy, crazy. This is a story that, oh, it's over? No, it's not over.
It's far from over. And I got most of this info on Wikipedia because I did get a lot more than was on the show. But we start in like March of 1960, Independence, Missouri. A cop shows up at the house of 20-year-old Sharon Kinney, and she is holding her little 2-year-old daughter. And she says that she was in the shower. She heard a gunshot go off, and her 25-year-old husband, James Kinney, was in the bedroom, shot once in the back of the head with a .22 caliber pistol, and the pistol was laying nearby. They try and get him to the hospital. He dies on the way to the hospital. I learned that 16-year-old Sharon, when they were dating, lied and told a 22-year-old James that he had gotten her pregnant to try and speed up their wedding. So we learned that this is kind of a history for her, but I also had to Google the age of consent. So if I die, please delete my browser history because I spent a lot of time on that.
Oof. Both of us. Yeah. It's just too much. It doesn't matter what I think that what the age of consent is, but I'm more comfortable with 18.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Mm. And like 16 and 22, that's a big difference. But keep in mind, we're in like the 1950s. So Sharon says that he was cleaning his gun and 2-year-old daughter Dana wanders in and she's like, "Daddy, come play with me. Come play with me." And she's picking up the gun and flipping it around and everything. And she says that she accidentally shot her father, which if it's not true, what an evil monster to put this on your 2-year-old for the rest of her life that she has to deal with that. But
now when was the, I mean, you have a couple guns. You have to clean them sometimes. Now, you never, ever, ever, not once, ever, clean a loaded gun.
Mm-hmm.
Ever. Like, it's like the first rule. So,
yeah.
Of course, we have to say that this is the first rule because we've heard time and time again that people accidentally get shot.
Yeah, and I would also say maybe the second rule is don't let your 2-year-old pick up and play with them. And apparently many, many people said that, oh, he always let her play with the gun. And the police took her to the precinct and had her test on that gun. And she was strong enough to pull the trigger. So, like,
I mean, it's a 22. There's not much to it.
Yeah, but a 2-year-old girl, I mean.
I guess, yeah. Girls can do whatever boys. No, I'm just kidding. But no. But I didn't really think about that. Yeah, too. But still, like, it's such a. And it could be a hair trigger for all we know. It's like boom. It's easy to pull that trigger.
Yeah. So this story just kind of sad, tragic story. It is what it is. So
and I kind of believe that she could have shot him.
It's possible. It's totally possible. So we meet author James C. Hayes. James C. Hayes is author of the book I'm Just an Ordinary Girl, the Sharon Kinney story. And it looks like, judged by the Amazon reviews, like, don't waste your time. Just go to Wikipedia. But she ended up collecting life insurance for over $29,000, which is over $250,000 in nowadays money. So she goes and buys herself a fancy new Thunderbird, and she seduces the man who sold it to her.
I love that little tidbit. It was just so like, your husband just died. You got $250,000. Well, the equivalent of $250,000 today.
Yeah.
And you're hooking up with the guy who's selling you the car. What kind of deal did she get?
Honestly, I don't know. The married guy, by the way, who gave her the car. Like, they just said... They said, Robert Stack said in the beginning, Sharon Kinney is a guy's woman. If you like your women fast, loose, and amoral or something like that, which, I mean, who doesn't? But the salesman is father of two, Walter T. Jones. So he's married and he's like, into you. Like, love what we got going on here. Thanks for letting me drive the Thunderbird, but I am not gonna leave my wife for you. So she's like, I'm pregnant with your baby. Who knows if that's true or not? As we said, she might have a history of like kind of falsely doing it. And the timing is very convenient. So he's like, I don't want to ever see you again. Like, don't call, whatever. So she calls his wife, 23-year-old Patricia Jones.
And it's like a Mad Men episode.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, I've been banging your husband and I'm pregnant with this kid. But she actually said, like, my sister has been banging your husband and is pregnant with his kid. So she's like, let's meet. Let's just talk woman to woman. And I'll tell you all about my sister who's pregnant, which obviously it's her. So Patricia has, you know,
if this ever happens to one of our listeners, just have the conversation on the phone.
Yeah, exactly. You're safest on the phone. And oh, what a psycho. But a carpool buddy from work drops Patricia off to meet Sharon. And Sharon's like, you know what? Let's go on a drive. Like, I don't really want to talk about this in front of your carpool buddy. Let's just go. We'll talk.
And have him follow. That's all I'm thinking. And it's a guy. He should have just followed, like, in a total, you know, sly way. But
I know. It's so messed up. So Patricia gets in her car. And, like, these are young girls. You see another girl, you're like, maybe this isn't a problem. But yeah, she got in and she never returned. So Walter, the husband, begins calling around and he's like, where's my wife? I haven't seen her. I am not taking care of these kids by myself. And he reaches the carpool buddy and the carpool buddy's like, I dropped her off with this woman. And he gives the exact description of Sharon Kinney. So Walter calls Sharon, and he's like, where's my wife? And she's like, oh, we met earlier so I could blow up your spot and talk all about how we have an affair. But I dropped her off and like I dropped her off near your guys' house and I saw her talking to some guy in like a green 1957 right. Ford. So
I could picture her saying something like, you know, I have to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have to go. John's on the other line.
He's getting us hot dogs at the Burger Hop.
Yeah, exactly.
I feel like it's a Happy Days episode with murder. It's crazy.
Yeah. So Walter was like, why don't we meet in person? So they meet in person. She's like, hey, Walter. And he like holds a key to her throat and is like, tell me what you did with my wife. So he knows like this is a crazy person.
I never thought of that. I guess you can hurt somebody. It's like a total gel type thing to do, like a shiv. Yeah.
It wouldn't tickle, like, but I mean,
my Volkswagen Beetle key is pretty sharp, but I mean, I don't know. Maybe it was like a thing back then. Maybe it'd sharpen your key. It would be a weapon. I don't know.
I mean, he's a car salesman. You got to use what you got.
Yeah. So
the next morning, Sharon's like, I'll help search for Patricia, me and John Boldis. John Boldis is like her side piece, has been her side piece since she was married to her husband, James, who.
Yeah, I'll take a ride. You know, he's thinking it's like a booty call. And I'll take a ride. Come on, let's go end up at Lover's Lane.
Yeah, because he's not wrong. It is kind of a booty call. So they're like, why don't we go to like Lookout Point, you know, just get all snuggly. So they get there and where are they parked in front of? They're parked right in front of the dead body of Patricia Jones, who had been shot 4 times.
Oh, man. So I think of the Back to the Future thing where it's kind of like, I never sat in a parked car with a boy.
Yeah, exactly. That scene. Oh, my God. That is so not okay. Back to the Future. Sorry. But,
yeah, I know.
Right where they park, they find her body. And John's like, let's go to the police. And Sharon's like, cool, let's go to the police. But first, can you drop me off and just like, don't tell the police I was with you.
So I don't need that right now.
Yeah, I'm going through a lot right now.
Yeah, like, I wonder if that was the thing. It's kind of like, look, you found the body. Don't get me involved. I don't need this right now. My husband died.
I mean, her husband died, like, this is probably like a year, I think.
Yeah, but you know, this is the, you know, she's a drama queen. There's no doubt about it. Yeah. She knows how to get men to do what she wants. I mean, clearly, right?
100%. Yeah. And John goes to the police, but he immediately rolls on her and says, oh, Sharon Kinney is the one you need to look at. She's the one who was with me when I found the body.
Yeah.
So they charge her with the murder of Patricia Jones. And they're like, since we're here, let's charge you for the death of your husband, James Kinney. Ugh. So she's out on bond. While she's out on bond, she gives birth to her second child, which is presumably the car salesman's kid. But, you know, You might want to get that DNA test.
Yeah.
I know there's not a DNA test. I'm just being silly. But,
that kid must still be around. I mean, well, maybe there's no DNA. But if we ever find her, maybe then they can do a DNA. Oh, no, we know she's the mother. We just don't know about the father. Oh, man. Yeah, this is a very strange story. This is like a very, like, I forget what it's called. Like one of those soap operas. It's a dramatic story.
Oh, my God. And we're not even like halfway there yet. Like, it gets so crazy. So the jury's all male and she is just like batting her eyelashes and sitting there coloring holy pictures. And the jury finds her not guilty in the case of Patricia. In fact, the jurors even came out and got her autograph.
No, I didn't get this. Was what this
conflict of interest?
Was this a complicated, like, big story at the time?
This was like the biggest story at the time. She's a beautiful woman.
Like nationwide story?
I don't know how widely it was circulated, but I don't know. She's gorgeous, and she had some celebrity.
It's one of those things where it's just kind of, for me anyway, it would have to be a pretty important person for me to have any interest of having that person scratch on a piece of paper. I know some people feel a little differently, of course, but.
Yeah, I don't know, but. Ugh, what a conflict of interest. Like, that is so crazy. But the trial for James's death start, and the jury this time finds her guilty of first degree murder. She seems to think it was because there was one woman in the jury, and that woman was, I don't know, jealous or something. But
it's kind of also, I mean, I've never been on a jury. I've been called for jury duty and thankfully never selected. But now that we talk about all this kind of stuff, I think maybe in the future I would have an interest. But
it is my dream to be on a jury ever since I was a kid. Do you know how good I am at judging people? Like, I would be like, Your Honor, this lady obviously did it. But can I tell you something so dorky?
Free lunch, too.
Yeah, I have been called for jury duty, and they never got that high to that number. So I was let go. But when I was a kid and I was in junior high, I signed up for this thing called peer court. Have you heard of this?
Peer court. It sounds really familiar. Is that like a public access type thing, or
no? So I was sitting there. We're all sitting there in the Lyceum, right? Of dun, like dun, the, dun, the dun, junior dun,
peer
high.
Court.
they bring in people and like kids, like juvenile kids, and then we hear their cases in like a mock court.
Whoa.
And then we get to assign the actual punishment. So I was all over that.
This is like a Nickelodeon show or something.
No, this is real life. So I remember one of the kids, I don't know if I'm like violating a non-disclosure agreement.
I just looked it up.
Oh, teen court. Well, one of the kids has stolen from a grocery store. And so I remember that one of the punishments we could give was that he had to like write a letter of apology and do a certain amount of community service. And that's what we did. But I was like all over it. And that is the last time I have ever served on a jury.
Well, I hope you end up on something because that's awesome. That sounds really, really interesting.
It was. Do you know the amount of power I felt? I was out of control. But it was
can we hang him?
Yeah, exactly. But back to our trial of John Boldis, the guy who was at Lover's Lane with her, testified that Sharon once offered him $1,000 to murder her husband.
And did we mention that he totally rolled on her? He completely gave, you might have mentioned it, but he gave her up like in the first sentence.
Yeah.
And she asked him not to.
Right. And to be fair, he later said like, he wasn't sure if it was a joke that she offered him this money, but it is what it is. When you offer that, I mean, it's going to come up in your trial.
Wink, wink. It doesn't really matter.
Yeah. So she was sentenced to life in prison. And in March of 1963, her verdict was overturned on some kind of technicality, little tiny legalese. So she's tried again, ends in a mistrial. Tried again, ends in a hung jury. Now, right before her fourth trial, she is released on bond. And here is where she meets Francis Pugliese. And he is a hairdresser / blacksmith, and they fall in love.
Yeah, this is a weird thing because I don't know if it's different now. I'm going to guess this is different now. If you are released on bond, you can't just leave the country.
Right. Yeah. And she was totally free and legal to go wherever the heck she wanted. So they're like, we are going to go to Mexico. And in the
She was like,
cruise,
I want to have margaritas. And I'm like,
I want
she's a
a
fun girl. Look at
pinata.
this. Good for
Yeah.
her.
She was all over him in the reenactment. She's like, I want margaritas. I want a pinata. Are we there yet? When are we going to get there? It's like,
He
oh
looked
my God.
like the guy from That 70s Show, the Spanish guy.
Yeah.
But,
or
sorry.
whatever.
But he's a hairdresser and blacksmith. What the hell does that mean?
I don't know, jack of all trades, I guess.
Yeah, but that's a little bit much. I mean, what, he makes the scissors and cuts with them? I don't know.
Oh, I didn't think about that. But once we get to Mexico, there is a series of misadventures, and what happens is she ends up shooting a man named Francisco Ordonez in
This
the back.
girl, she can't take her anywhere.
She can't not shoot people. Like, it's her thing. So she shot him in the back, claims it's self-defense, which is unusual when somebody is shot in the back. So she also shot a hotel employee who responded to the gunshots. He was injured. He survived. But Kenny says that she was going to go to the guy's hotel room because he had photographs that he wanted to show her. And then once she's in his room, he started making sexual advances on her. My theory
Yeah.
is she either was pretending or not to be a sex worker, and once she got there, she would like rob him because it sounds like they were just going from like seedy hotel to seedy
Yeah,
hotel,
this
and
was
she
him getting rolled by her. That was it. I in my opinion.
I think so too. And she's a woman who trades on her beauty. So I think that's probably what happened. Police arrest her and find that the gun that she killed Ordonez with is the same exact gun that killed Patricia Jones. But because of double jeopardy, she can never be retried for that
But
case.
let me ask you. Okay. So Mexican police arrest her, right? And found that the gun, I mean, that isn't that, I mean, how would they be able to determine whether it was the gun or not? I mean, unless they did they get the ballistics from the states, or did they send the gun to the states? This is where we don't get a lot of information here. And from what I understand, the 60s, we weren't really working so closely with Mexico.
Yeah, and I mean, we weren't working like state to state with police officers, let alone like to Mexico. I don't know how they decided it was the same exact gun. I
Maybe
don't
it
know.
was the same police officer who determined that the twins' shotgun was the same one.
Yeah, maybe,
Pokemon
yeah.
sticker, maybe.
Well,
Just it
she
seems
ended
kind
up.
of weird. Like, and she does go to jail. She's sentenced in Mexico for 13 years,
Yeah,
but
where
in a
she is.
Mexican prison.
In a Mexican prison where she is known as La Pistolera, which is the gunfighter. So she even has like a fun nickname because she's just like this
That's going to be
beautiful
your
woman.
nickname, I think.
Oh, I love that. I mean, yeah, I
Pistol
mean, no
Kim.
disrespect. I know people died, but God, this story was entertaining. So she serves less than 5 of those years in Mexico when all of a sudden on December 7th of 1969, there is a blackout and she squeezes through a jail cell and completely vanished. It's speculated that maybe some of the guards were on the take with this one.
5 months after Woodstock, she's escaping from a Mexican prison.
And she has never been seen since, ever.
Mean, I'm sure she's been seen, just not, we don't know about it. If she's alive today, she'd be 80 years old. I don't
That's
know.
it.
She
I mean, we
lives
get.
a wild life, this one.
Yeah, and we get an age progress photo of her. She appears on her cheek to have like a port wine birthmark on her upper cheek, but you know, on Unsolved, everyone's like, "Oh, she was my second grade teacher," and like all this kind of stuff. But I don't trust those people on Unsolved.com.
Yeah, she kind of looks like my mom in the 60s. It's
Oh
weird.
my
You know
God.
what? I remember you made a comment like, this is what I imagine your mom looks like. And my mom looks nothing like that woman, but I'm going to send you a picture of my mom. And what my mom, what she looked like, in the 60s, and what she looked like, like at her like 70th birthday party or something. But yeah, I mean, it's just one of those kind of, she really looks like the kind of person that like, she is an attractive woman, and she probably had a lot of charisma. I think that it was more the charisma than her physical beauty that sold people. And yeah, I never heard of her. She's somebody who I think I want to go down a little bit of a rabbit hole and learn a little bit more, because I think there's more to learn.
Yeah, and it was honestly, like I said, I know people died, but it was a very entertaining case. The fun reenactments were great. I thought this was like a perfect one to end on.
Yeah, me too. And well, Kim, thank you so much for getting together for this episode of Unsolved Mysteries Rewind. By this point, we have already released at least one episode of our Unsolved Mysteries old time radio throwback, which we're still determining a name for this. It's kind of an additional thing to the entire series where we can go back in time and learn about the original Unsolved Mysteries that people just kind of, it's really off the radar of pretty much everyone.
Yeah, and just stay tuned on our Facebook page, Unsolved Mysteries Rewind Podcast on Facebook. You can find all the information there. And if you're on the computer with nothing to do, how about you leave us a 5-star review? That would really help us out.
Yeah, and we also have a lot of really cool stuff in the development stage, which is really exciting. Do you want to talk about the one little item that we received this week?
Yes, we have official Robert Stack stickers.
Official Unsolved Mysteries Rewind.
Right. Unsolved Mysteries Rewind, but oh my God, that looks so good on your car.
Yeah.
Your sawed-off shotgun. Like, just these stickers are amazing.
I'm going to take my Pokemon sticker off and put a Robert Stack sticker on my shotgun.
They look so cool. I'm excited to receive mine in the mail.
Yeah, I have to get those in the mail to you, but by this point, I don't know. I'm guessing that when people are listening to this, it will be 2021, and we'll have a new president and everything.
Woohoo!
But all right, well, Kim, always thank you so much for the amazing work that you put into each and every episode, and I'll talk to you the next roundabout.
Tonight we have been confronted with an entire catalog of unexplained and unsolved events. Tune in next time as Unsolved Mysteries Rewind discusses another collection of unsolved mysteries. Until then, we can only look and wonder.